Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Hurricane Jose moves up the Atlantic toward the East Coast. By Kate Samuelson and Pratik Rabala. Hurricane Jose is the latest storm to threaten the Caribbean and the U.S. as it follows in Harvey and Irma's wake in the Atlantic. Jose, regaining some of its strength, was upgraded from a tropical storm to a Category 1 hurricane Friday afternoon. Previously as strong as Category 4, Jose has passed north of the Caribbean islands, including the Bahamas, and is making its way north, where it could threaten the east coast of the U.S. this weekend into next week. The southern New England coast is potentially in the storm's path. Jose is expected to produce high surf and life-threatening rip current conditions along the coast as it moves up the Atlantic, AP reports. Jose follows Hurricane Irma, which tore into the Caribbean islands in Florida, killing at least 55 people and damaging thousands of properties. The full extent of the damage is still being determined. Insane Clown Posse talks to Time about its FBI lawsuit. By Nate Hopper. On September 16th, the multi-platinum clown-faced rap group Insane Clown Posse and its fans, who call themselves Juggalos, will march on the National Mall to protest the FBI. In 2011, the Justice Department declared that the Juggalos comprised a loosely organized hybrid gang akin to the infamous Bloods and Crips that was rapidly expanding into many U.S. communities. The DOJ reported that a small number of Juggalos are forming more organized subsets and engaging in more gang-like criminal activity, such as felony assaults, thefts, robbery, and drug sales. Insane Clown Posse's frontman, stage named Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope, dispute the accusation and classification, which they say has caused some of their fans to lose jobs or custody cases. With the support of the ACLU of Michigan, the group hails from Detroit, and Insane Clown Posse has filed a lawsuit against the department and the FBI. While the march coincides with a pro-Donald Trump rally, the group has no explicit political affiliations. Violent J and Shaggy 2 Dope say they oppose discrimination of any kind. The two men, wearing their makeup, told Time that they hope the march will help change the government's position.
The incredible story behind a haunting picture of a POW in Vietnam, by Lily Rothman. The man in the picture keeps his eyes to the ground. Though there are no walls keeping him in, the image was taken in a rice field, there's no mistaking that he's a prisoner. The rope that binds his arms is only just visible, but the militia woman guarding him with her bayonet is plain to see. And yet, 50 years after that striking photograph was taken, he remembers that the event it captures held for him a secret sense of possibility. That day was a breath of relief and cause for a silent prayer of gratitude. The man's name is Dewey Wayne Waddell. Today, at 82, he's retired and living in Marietta, Georgia. Retired Air Force Colonel Waddell, who goes by Wayne, spoke to Time about the story behind the picture. "It's quite a shock when you're zooming along and then all of a sudden you're sitting on the ground," Waddell says of what happened on July 5, 1967, when his plane was shot down on a mission over North Vietnam. Because his parachute did not fully open when he ejected from his plane, he knew it was possible the Air Force would believe that he died in the fall. "One of the first thoughts I had when I was sitting on the ground was, everybody I see from now on may be wanting to kill me. That focuses your attention. But conveniently, they didn't try to kill me. They just wanted to capture me." Waddell was imprisoned at the infamous Hanoi Hilton, and it was there that he recalls his captors playing him a few recorded war crimes confessions from other American prisoners of war. It was the era of Bertrand Russell's War Crimes Tribunal, in which the philosopher led an investigation in Sweden into U.S. actions in Vietnam, and Waddell was told that these confessions would be used at the tribunal, and that, like it or not, he would be confessing. A little more than a week later, he was told that he was going somewhere to be tested, and that if he did not cooperate, his life could not be guaranteed. He was given his own flight suit to wear, but it looked bloody. Red ink had been splashed on it. I figured I was going to a kangaroo court where you're guilty when you walk in to do one of those confessions, he recalls. So I was very pleasantly surprised when I got up there and they took off the blindfold to see where I was. He says he knew right away what was going on and why it was not a tribunal of any kind. Though there's no trace of them in the photograph made that day, there were two Caucasian men present, one with a still camera and the other shooting video. He would later find out that they were a team from East Germany working on an East German television docu-series about the war called Pilots in Pajamas. They had me walk up and down the rice paddy a few times and said, "Keep your head down and don't say anything." But I always got right at the camera and looked up real quick, hoping that if these pictures got out, somebody would recognize me, he says. I was looking for any way for my family to know I was alive. That possibility that the men with the cameras would produce some image that would make its way into the world and into the hands of his loved ones, who might otherwise believe him dead, was enough to color the memory of that day with unexpectedly positive feelings. It helps, of course, that his plan worked. Pilots in Pajamas was shown on East German television in early 1968, at which point the broadcast was picked up by U.S. military monitoring of the communist nation's propaganda. Toward the end of one of the segments, there was Dewey Wayne Waddell, his eyes flicking up to meet the camera just as he'd planned. "Well, this thing that showed up turned out to be exactly what I'd hoped for," he recalls. "When the Air Force saw that, they pulled off several stills and sent them to my family, who identified me, of course. So that's what changed my status from MIA to POW. Waddell was released on March 4, 1973. But the story of the photograph doesn't end there. Years later, at a cartoon and photography convention, a friend of Waddell's happened to meet the son of one of the German photographers, Thomas Billhart, the man with the still camera. Later, on a visit to Berlin, that friend went to see Billhart's work, and there, hanging on the wall, was a picture of Wayne Waddell taken the day of the Pilots in Pajamas filming. The friend arranged for the former prisoner and the photographer to connect. They met in Berlin in the late 1990s at a nice little session that was recorded for local television and the newspaper, and upon leaving, Waddell's wife asked to purchase the picture to take home. A few years later, Waddell was interviewed once again about his experience, this time for a piece in the Georgia Tech Alumni Magazine about graduates who had been prisoners of war. The magazine ended up using that photograph on the cover. It also subsequently made the cover of a book about the POW experience. It was at that point that Waddell discovered that he had been re-identified at some point along the way. In the caption information that travels with the photograph, he's listed as Pewy Waddell. In recent decades, Waddell has returned to Vietnam several times, the first time in 1994 with his wife and children. Though he says he was apprehensive as their plane neared Hanoi, it, quote, brought back memories of high-speed run-ins on bombing runs, he says. He has fond memories of the place from later trips. He's noticed the spread of capitalism and of the English language, and found the people he met friendly and accommodating. During a visit to the Hanoi prison, when one of the Vietnamese officers present asked him what he'd been thinking when he'd been there as a prisoner, Waddell responded that he'd been thinking, "I sure would like to get out of here." His host, he says, thought that was funny. And now, a half century after that photograph was taken, Waddell says he's intrigued to see the nation's eyes turn to Vietnam as a piece of history, as the subject of a documentary rather than daily news. "That's an interesting thing for me that I've pondered a few times. The way I've described it, it's like a movie that I saw, except I was in it," he says. "As a matter of fact, it seemed I had a starring role." Why Robots Will Improve Manufacturing Jobs, by Joe Kaiser. Kaiser is the president and CEO of Siemens AG. There is a widely held view about what is coming in manufacturing. It goes something like, "Move over, humans. We don't need you anymore. Robots will take it from here." But it isn't true. This is not manufacturing's future. People have feared the march of the machine for centuries, yet for just as long, machines have changed work. They have not replaced it. And the emerging fourth industrial revolution, even with its digital automated assembly lines, is not an exception to this trend. As this new way of doing business becomes a reality, humans and machines will each play a critical role in manufacturing success. Here are a couple of reasons why. First, it's true that digital manufacturing does cut out the middleman. More and more routine, repetitive assembly tasks will be taken over by machines. But as certain jobs disappear, new ones open up in other parts of the factory. Germany, in many ways, exemplifies this trend. Today, German manufacturers deploy 3 times more robots than U.S. companies, but they also still employ more humans. Relative to the size of our economies, Germany's manufacturing workforce is twice the size of America's. Second, from its very beginning, the fourth industrial revolution has never presented manufacturers with an either-or choice, robots or humans. It's always been about combining the talents of both. Ultimately, it's the convergence of artificial and human intelligence that will enable manufacturers to achieve a new era of speed, flexibility, efficiency, and connectivity in the 21st century. Machines have the ability to assemble things faster than any human ever could, but humans possess the analytics, domain expertise, and valuable knowledge required to solve problems and optimize factory floor production. This is precisely what we now see at Siemens Amberg Electronics plant in, yes, Germany. Over the past 25 years, Amberg has evolved into a fully digital plant with automation rising tremendously. But what has changed the most during this time isn't the number of employees. What has changed is productivity. The same size workforce, about 1,200 workers who've been trained and retrained for digital manufacturing, has increased productivity by more than 1,000%. For now, Amberg is something of an exception, but it won't be for long. Where we are now is only the beginning. Artificial intelligence is here and being rapidly commercialized, with new applications being created not just for manufacturing, but also for energy, healthcare, and oil and gas. This will change how we all do business. There has never been a bigger opportunity for us to add value for customers, and that's what makes this new machine age unstoppable. At the same time, companies have both a business need and social responsibility to be equally invested in humans. The transformation of the factory floor must be met by a large-scale, company-led commitment to industrial reskilling for current and aspiring employees. The responsibility is now ours to ensure that digital manufacturing is accessible to anyone willing to learn, work hard, and pursue new pathways in training. Germany has long confronted the human challenge with a dual system of education, a public-private system that invests in, promotes, and continuously updates training and educational pathways to established and growing industries. Participants attend public vocational schools while receiving on-the-job training on industry standards through a paid apprenticeship in a private sector company. This system also serves a dual purpose to both business and society. Companies win by having a strong pipeline of workers with relevant skills and knowledge. Society wins as young people gain fast tracks into good-paying jobs and exciting careers with ladders to climb, increasing economic opportunity and strengthening the middle class. Industry leaders just have to remember that while robots are programmable, with humans, trust is earned. We have to prove that digital manufacturing is inclusive. Then the true narrative will emerge. Welcome, robots. You'll help us. But humans are still our future.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.